Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Whether that's live music, the crack of a campfire, or kids laughing on an adventure.
To start planning your trip, visit tnvacation.com.
Tennessee sounds perfect.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, for tuning in. We have a very special announcement today. We are joined with a close friend of ours and friend of the show. Welcome our guest super producer, Andrew Ahow, a.k.a. Cool Guy Deluxe Howard. Andrew, we'll keep this part in, but usually there's a sound cue after that that sounds cool. I don't know. Noel, what do you think would be a good sound cue?
Something with snaps, sort of like something from the Grease soundtrack or like the beginning of West Side Story, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da, don't sue us, da-da-do, you know? So yeah, see, you hear Andrew's snaps? Those are the sweet dulcet snaps of Andrew Howard, a.k.a. Swan Hummingbird Howard. Hurrah.
A.k.a. Big Tim's. AKA Tigerfoot. Let's just do an episode where we just do AKAs for Andrew.
I love it. AKAs for Andrew.com. Do you know that's my favorite REM song, you guys? I think is Swan Hummingbird off of Life's Rich Pageant. Know what it's about, but it's a very nonsensical classic Michael Stipe lyric. But yeah, it's the lyric is Swan Hummingbird, hurrah, we're all free now. What noisy cats are we? But it's not really about cats or swans or hummingbirds. There's a character named Johnny Red at some point, but today's episode is about one of those things, mainly the swans. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I put REM, some of their work in this beautiful, rarefied musical era where lyrics could sound deep and profound and they didn't have to make sense. Shout out to you, Smashing Pumpkins.
Oh, I know.
Right? I know it. Okay, before we quote Smashing Pumpkins. Oh, I forgot to say, I'm Ben, longtime listeners. You know most of us from this show, and you probably have heard of swans because you are right, Noel. Today's episode is all about swans, but it's not about all swans.
Mm-hmm. And it's also not about the seminal noise rock band Swans.
No. And it concerns a queen, not Freddie Mercury's queen, but the Queen of England, and a river, not all rivers, but the River Thames. Now, I have a brief anecdote here. Once in London, I had the fortune to go to this restaurant that I always dreamed of visiting, a place called St. John. It's famous for serving things that would usually be thrown away, and it's called traditional British cooking, but we're talking about stuff like, you know, sweetbreads, tongue, brain, stuff like that. And that is where, for the first time, I ate a grouse and I realized that you can indeed eat many, many birds. Here in the US, we mainly eat chicken, right? Or duck. Once a year, bound by tradition, we eat turkey. But back in the day, swan was not just a foul dish, get it, that everybody was familiar with, but eating it was a mark of status for a very weird reason.
Yes, this is correct. It was a particularly weird reason, sort of a weird historical flex, that only the most fortunate amongst the citizens of London town were able to eat swans, and that's because they actually had to pay a vig to the monarchy in order to consume these illustrious birds, which also, by the way, really cantankerous birds. We have a friend and former colleague Scott Benjamin, who has a very terrifying story about being dragged by a swan into like a moat situation because it wanted his ice cream cone as a kid. And that to me is just like the stuff of nightmares.
Swans are terrible. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that one.
Worse than geese, yeah. Which is saying a lot.
I was attacked by a swan once in Dollywood and it got my finger. And I was terrified because I had not seen one up close before. And I did not understand that when they're honkers, their bills, their terrifying mouth parts are open. The inside of it looks like the inside of a nightmare. It looks very Lovecraftian. It got my finger. Swans suffer from a stereotype because in the West, we've always heard the story of the ugly duckling that grew to become a swan. So we all, for some reason, assume that they are as nice personality-wise as they look. And that could not be further from the truth. They're real pills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of like swans representing elegance and daintiness grace, you know, like Swan Lake and the whole balletic, there's a whole move. I think it must be originated from Swan Lake, the dying swan, which is sort of this cliche ballet move where you sort of, you know, like crouch down slowly as though you are a dying swan. Fascinating stuff, the way we associate these absolute demonic creatures with all of these positive traits. You're right, Ben, the inside of their mouth, it's like they're ringed with weird rows of like Cthulhu teeth or something. Mm-hmm. Like it's really unsettling. But no, we're burying the lead here. We said it and then got distracted by the nightmare that is a swan. But yeah, the Queen of the United Kingdom, also known as the head of the Commonwealth, also known as the defender of the faith, also the commander-in-chief of the British Armed Forces, sovereign of the most noble order of the Garter. Oh my God. Sovereign of the most ancient and most noble order of the Thistle. These are all titles bestowed upon Elizabeth II, the Queen of England. Also, another one, perhaps lesser known, is the Seigneur of the Swans.
It's true. This is something that may be unfamiliar to a lot of our non-British listeners. We like how Arthur MacGregor explains it in a 1995 issue of Anthropozoologica. It turned out that swans, in this part of the world, swans were the subject of a big controversy, a debate. Who owns them? Who breeds them? Who gets to eat them? British courts and town councils had been arguing about this since the Middle Ages. By 1361, the crown had appointed a royal swan herd, and by 1463, there was a full-time swan moat. And commissioners were appointed there to hear entirely swan-related disputes. In my head, Dick Wolf, if you're still listening to the show, this is Law and Order Swan Court. Dum 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 dum. Honk.
Mm-hmm.
Right, like you can feel me there on the brainstorming. But there's a legend behind it. There is a legend that a mute swan was introduced to Britain by Richard I in the 12th century, and that he brought swans back with him from his campaigns in the Crusades.
Wait, so like a swan that couldn't honk? A honkless swan?
Mm-hmm.
That sounds okay. I'm here for that, honestly. The honk is part of the thing that squigs me out about him.
Yeah, just Google swan tongues. and be prepared if you're running low on some cosmic horror content. It's interesting. So that was the legend people told each other about how swans came to be, especially in the Thames. But today, ornithologists believe the swan was probably native to the country, and archaeological evidence of these creatures dates as far back as 10,000 years ago. So Richard I may have brought one honkless swan with him after the Crusades, but they were already well established in the country beforehand.
Oh, real quick, this could be off mic, or maybe it's not. A mute swan is not a mute swan. It's just the name of the species. It's called a mute swan. Let's let it ride. Not a honkless swan at all. Still quite noisy. But that's the species of swan. That's the type of swan you would normally picture. You know, big, fluffy, winged bodies, the swan-like neck, and a big orange beak. And, you know, I'm looking at images of swans, and, you know, when you see them frozen like that, some of them are like, have their little necks intertwining. There is some romantic qualities to this imagery, I get, but it definitely doesn't match up to the reality of being chased by a bloodthirsty swan. We're going to let this stuff go and tell the dang story, but I'm a little bit triggered by this episode.
I'm not going to let it go. Even if it wasn't honky, that's not enough. I mean, let us not forget that under that cute orange bill, there is something that looks like an ancient creature from the darkness between the stars. That tongue is unclean. Anyhow, you're right, Noel. You're right. We should soldier on. We should sail away, sail away. Swans were luxury goods. We know that from at least the 12th century onward. You really wanted to flex on someone in the days before a Rolex? You walked around with a swan and people were like, whoa, VIP. It's actually been referred to as the medieval equivalent of having a Rolex or even driving a Lamborghini or Lambo for the cool, obnoxious people in the crowd. If you owned a swan, people would often just assume that you were of the noble class. It was up there with running hounds or flying a hawk, you know, maybe being a falconer.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that they were such, you know, features at these big banquets is because they literally were like a showpiece, because they would include the skin and the feathers, and they would have like incense shoved in its horrible, hellish maw, you know, and it would be like a centerpiece. Like we've talked about this. There's a really cool British chef named Heston Blumenthal. And he has a show called Heston Blumenthal's Feast, where he recreates crazy elaborate, you know, kind of showy dinners from different eras in history. And I'm pretty sure he does some spin on this kind of Christmas swan dinner. But they would be served to huge numbers of people, and there would be an equally huge number of swans. Like 40 swans, I think, were ordered for Henry III's Christmas dinner, and that was in 1247 at Winchester Cathedral. So back to Elizabeth I, swan was quite popular as a feast dish, especially when you really went extra with it and stuffed it with like 9 other birds, which was the origination of what is known today as the turducken. But this is like that on a much more elaborate and grandiose kind of scale, right? It's like, oh my God, so strange and macabre, really? You know, like I did nothing appetizing about that. Nothing appetizing to me about like a Russian nesting doll of dead roasted birds.
I'm into it.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll get down on a matryoshka, you know? It's got a goose, a duck, a mallard, a chicken, a pheasant, a partridge, a pigeon, and a woodcock. That's in descending order. And I think that can feed 30 people. It's still not in the class of the fabled stuffed camel, which we might talk about in a weird aside in a future episode.
Hey, and if you get to the woodcock, and you might find the prize. There's a prize inside the woodcock. Like that's how you know you've that's that yeah and then you're crowned king of the potty, belle of the ball,
but still not the queen.
No, definitely not the queen. She is the original bae, you know. Yeah. So yeah, and it would be stuffed in that ascending order, you know, seasoned and such, and then cooked. And then it would be redressed. And again, it would be made to look, it's like taxidermy. It's right. A weird combination of like taxidermy and chefery, which again, I keep coming back to this word, but really macabre, like very, like just kind of, it just doesn't, nothing appetizing about this. But again, this is coming from somebody who I only want to see a bird if it doesn't look like a bird anymore. It just looks like, you know, delicately sliced chicken on my plate. But when you start introducing the eyes and the beak and the neck, it really turns me off from eating bird.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
There's an interesting thing here. I was fascinated by medieval cuisine for a long time. In the rarefied air of royal feast or feast held by very well-to-do people, we would see this tendency to prize presentation sometimes over taste. There was this whole fad of making one animal look or taste like another animal. Kind of, in a way, it's an alchemy that is a predecessor of the later practice we call molecular gastronomy today, with, you know, where we have our pals like Richard Blaise pioneering all these strange new techniques. But let's talk turkey. Matter of fact, let's talk swan. How did they actually taste? The good news here is that if you were someone like me who feels that turkey is, not to burn any bridges here, turkey is a little overrated and it can be tough to cook a whole one well, you will be perhaps surprised to note that people who have eaten swans in the past say they're pretty tasty. Mm-hmm. It's more like a duck than like a goose, right?
I don't know that I've had goose either, but I really love duck because it's, I don't know, I don't really care for the word gamey. It's not appealing to me, but that people do use that to describe something that tastes a little more, I don't know, wild, I guess. Even that's weird. I'm trying to put a metric on what that means. Like dark meat, I think it tastes a little more, I don't know, like it's still got blood in it or something, like a little ironier. I don't know. I'm not doing a very good job here. But yeah, I think duck almost tastes more like steak than it does like chicken or something. Like that's what I'm going to get. Yeah. So it almost is like splitting the difference between like what the umami and the quality of like red meat might be than what like purely white meat or chicken, you know, very run of the mill meat might taste like, somewhere in between those two. Because there's some interesting variants in some of the descriptions of eating swan that come from a Mental Floss article. And they range from tough to chewy to even a little fishy, which is weird. I guess that makes sense, though, because they are water-dwelling creatures that eat fish. Then this is a good one. The idea of it being tasting like goose flavored venison, mm-hmm. which is all about the texture. I think venison really is, again, it's not quite like a steak. Venison is almost somewhere between like a chicken and a steak. It's all about texture, but the idea of it being goose flavored is interesting.
It's the gamey nature.
Mm-hmm.
Venison is commonly held in the West as the number one example of something tasting quote unquote gamey. It's just, it might smell stronger. It may have a bolder flavor. So maybe they're saying that swan has this, swan, unlike duck, really pops in your mouth.
Mm-hmm. I love things that pop in my mouth. You ever had boba tea with the popping bobas? Like, you bite them and they like shoot out weird juice in your mouth. Mm. I'm a fan. It really weirds some people out. But no, it's true. I have had a venison burger, but I don't know that I've actually eaten like a big old cut of venison. But yeah, I need to expand my meat horizons. But the thing about the swan, though, is it was more than just kind of a weird culinary flex. It was like, it was very much entrenched in the British identity. You know, it was something that was a point of pride and something that even today, I mean, people from Britain refer to going to see the swans all the time. I mean, it's like very much something that's wrapped up in the identity of living in London. And, you know, as a country in the UK in 1496, the secretary of the Venetian ambassador wrote of the swans in London. They were truly a beautiful thing to behold, one of 2,000 tame swans upon the River Thames. Then during Elizabeth I's reign, a German lawyer by the name of Paul Henser described all of these swans as living, quote, in great security, nobody daring to molest, much less kill any of them under penalty of a large fine. And this is from a Smithsonian Mag article about the fascinating history of the British throne's swans. So what was the process like, Ben, if you did want to eat one? Because the whole point of this episode, I think, is that they were under the guard and care of the British crown. So it's like, did you buy one and raise them yourself? Or like, I mean, surely the swans in the Thames weren't up for grabs in that way, right?
Well, one thing that human history has taught me, as well as many of us listening today, is that human beings will resort to the most ridiculous lengths to perpetrate a class system, right? We can't forget, this is the same species that has outlawed certain haircuts and certain colors based on socioeconomic status. So swans were considered sort of the default property of the monarchy. They were called royal fowl. But the rules started to evolve in the 1400s. At the beginning of the 15th century, if you were wealthy enough, you could buy the right to own, sell, and eat swans. But to do this, first off, you had to be a landowner. Secondly, you had to be pretty well off. And third, you had to buy something called a swan mark. And you would carve this swan mark into the beaks of your birds.
Wow.
Later in 1482, the crown made this like solid law. Only landowners of a certain income can keep these birds. And this is funny to me because one thing I've always found fascinating about London is the sheer amount of taxation. For various things, like there was a window tax, I think there was a television tax, and this was the swan tax. So really all you got for paying this fee was the right to make this carving or brand on your swan beaks. And if you didn't do this, there would be consequences. It's funny because it wasn't always the same mark, right? It was a specific kind per like swan mark agreement.
That's right. There were actually hundreds of different types of swan marks, and you can even find entire books dedicated to keeping track of all of the various ones, and they would be different symbols, almost like a family crest, or you know, that you would think of, or like a tartan or whatever, like in Scotland. Things like swords or crossbows, or elaborate calligraphic kind of markings, like heraldic symbols, and then eventually it got a little more simple, and they just made them letters. But yeah. Every year, something called a Swan Master, of which there were many, but they were designated as like the keepers of the swans, would row on a boat out through the open waters to determine the ownership of every single mark on these swans' beaks and make sure that they knew who owned them. And any of the unmarked birds belonged to the crown. So this is, you totally answered my question, Ben. It definitely was a super elaborate, dare I say, overly so process. But only those who owned that right, that again was very convoluted set of criteria that went into your ability to own that right, could own swans. Mm-hmm. And they were very, very expensive. It's almost like, think of it as like buying like a taxi medallion or something, you know? That's you were investing in the long term, like, because, you know, if you had a swan, I guess you could breed the swan, or I don't know, like, was it limited to just that one swan and the life of that swan? Surely you could do with that swan what you wanted and use it to create more swans.
Yeah, you had to breed them, but you had to be sure to mark them back when they were young swans or cygnets, because otherwise they automatically belong to the monarchy. It's weird, so much legal work went into this. Like, local councils would have swan collectors that would round up wild swans, add them to flocks. I already talked about Law and Order Swan Court. Doom, 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 honk. There's a really fascinating thing in 1570 called the Order of Swans. It's a legal document that sort of articulates the rules relating to these birds specifically, and it shows us just how high the fines were for people who were flouting the law. They said, if any person do raise out, counterfeit, or alter the mark of any swan, they shall suffer 1 year's imprisonment. And this is where, I don't know about you guys, this is where I learned about a crime I had never heard of. If you commit swanage, that is killing swanage, if you kill an adult swan, or if you even steal the eggs, then you will also be punished with a very harsh sentence, likely imprisonment, because we have to remember, many people over history at this point might be killing adult birds because they had to feed their family, or stealing eggs for the same reason.
That's exactly right. This is the kind of thing that you hear about in like fairy tales, you know, where the father of the poverty-stricken family steals a single egg from the queen's, flock or whatever, and then gets cursed by an evil witch or something like that. But this was a little bit more grounded, where you were in prison. And there was a thing called, I love this term, a swan's moot, that was an event that would be convened in order to deal with various issues that would arise in terms of swan ownership. So it really was like a whole subsystem of legal mumbo jumbo that went into this whole idea of swan ownership. It's fascinating. And there were a couple of exceptions, though, to which lower class people might have access to swans, because of the whole system being designed, for the super wealthy. Oftentimes the barrier to entry for swan ownership just wasn't reachable for the lower class. If you weren't an officially recognized swan mark bearer, then it was forbidden to sell swans or to breed swans. Like, it wasn't just like the swans in the Thames. It was the idea of swans.
Right.
Like, as an animal, that's crazy. Like, that's not something that we have any equivalent for. I don't believe. Well, maybe it was certain exotic animals that are like
pandas.
Not technically right. That's right. That's, yeah, maybe so. But that more has to do with the fact that those are endangered and there's conservation, which we will get to on this issue as well in a little bit. But yeah, it's true. If you weren't an officially recognized swan keeper, you weren't allowed to sell them. You couldn't hunt them. And you certainly couldn't eat them. And God forbid you try to steal one or kill one that was actually in the Thames. You would be, quick work would be made of you, my friend, my historical friend. But there was an exception made for certain more, let's say, blue collar workers, winemakers, and dyers, literally folks who dyed clothing and things. There were these kind of guilds that were given a pass to participate in swan ownership. Ben, can you unpack this a little bit for us? It's really interesting and a little bit complicated.
Yeah. So this is another one of my favorite historical aspects of London. Inside London, there's something called the City of London. They're different. The City of London has these powerful historical organizations called livery companies. They're usually styled the Worshipful Company of insert here. So like the Worshipful Company of Dyers or the Worshipful Company of Venters or so on. They've had this really strange relationship with the monarchy that over the centuries has become defined by tradition and numerous exceptions to the rules of the day. So the act of the monarchy to exempt the Venters and Dyers, to essentially allow them to have swans without going to jail, is one more example of the carrot and the carrot and stick approach that the monarchy used to work with the trade guilds. Because we have to remember, this is while the mercantile class is on the rise. You know what I mean? You can be wealthy and you don't automatically have to be a duchess or a king or a queen. So we don't know exactly why they were granted this exemption, but we can safely assume it was meant to strengthen that working relationship. And then over time, other people got involved. The Ilchester family is the third exception. They're one of the only three entities who have a right to the swans, the Dyers, the Venters, and the Ilchesters. I would imagine, if we're just wildly speculating and making things up, that maybe the Dyers were giving them a royal discount on fancy clothes. And I think getting in good with the Venters speaks for itself, because who doesn't like to knock a few back when you're running merry old England? As for the Ilchester family, that may be a story for another day.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity. It's designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals to help cover unexpected expenses, plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. In other words, it's like getting a paycheck for life. We'll say that again. A paycheck for life. Guaranteed. Sounds too good to be true? It's not. It's the Parity Flex annuity. And it's one more example of their commitment to creating a better financial future for women. One where they feel empowered, not excluded, and ready to take on whatever their next chapter holds. Gainbridge believes financial flexibility and security are things we all could use more of. At retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Who's with us? Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Please visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, for product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Eventually, swan kind of transitioned to this traditional food, right? It wasn't swan. It's not just for feast anymore, but it became part of Christmas celebrations. You know, goose or swan.
It did. And I really like this notion of a status meat. I just have to say, I guess maybe what today would be a status meat, like filet mignon, you know, is there like an expensive cut of like rack of lamb or something like that? What would be a status meat?
Ortolan, tiger tongues.
There you go.
Well, endangered species. I don't think we should eat them, but shark fin soup.
Foie gras.
Yes, the cruelest status meat of them all.
Yeah.
Ahow on the Khao.
I'll take it. Yeah.
Okay. We'll do it. Our Kobe beef, you know, something that's like a very, like raised in a very specific way, very rarefied conditions, fed with a certain type of grain or what have you. That would be maybe today's equivalent of status meat.
Veal, caviar.
Totally. And they're all quite pricey. And, you know, swan was sort of like it had seen its day in the sun as a status meat of the time. It was still a delicacy and used as part of Christmas celebrations up until the 18th century. But it was still only legal to kill and eat one if you had that swan mark. And so it did kind of remain a luxury good into the Victorian period when it sort of became a little less cool. You know how fashions are. They're very fleeting at times. And I think this one stuck around for a pretty good amount of time, considering how most trends are. But by the 20th century, it really wasn't eaten. And the whole idea of swan marks still stuck around, but more as like a, almost like a tradition. And then it stopped. So I sort of started being red flagged by a lot of like organizations that look at animal cruelty and said that it wasn't cool to scratch letters into the beak of the swans. Cause you know, I think those are sort of bony, but I bet it wasn't a pleasant experience, right?
No, I don't think the swans themselves would have voted for it had they had the swan vote. But you're right. The decline of this practice was also pretty slow. In this might surprise some people to know that animal rights activists in the late 1800s were the driving force behind the end of the swan markings. They said it constituted unnecessary suffering. And so eventually Queen Alexandra, who was married to King Edward VII, stopped the royal birds at least from being marked. But it was not until 1998 that the law was changed such that it was no longer an act of treason to eat a swan in the UK, unless, you know, you had your paperwork, your swan mark, and so on. As a native species, mute swans are still under legal protection, though. It's not just the Queen's gimme all them impulse anymore, though. Now swans are protected as wild birds under the Wildlife and Countryside Act of 1981, which means that even now in 2020, it is illegal to kill or keep swans. You can still technically be guilty of swanage. Oh, how far we've come. Oh, and this is the weirdest part. Noel, maybe you can help me with this. Who still owns all the swans?
I think the Queen still owns every unmarked mute swan. And that's exactly right. And here's the thing, though. There is, and this is a tradition, and this is something that, like, you know, the Brits are all about tradition. I think it was off mic. We were talking about, like, things like funny hats that happen for very specific purposes or to indicate different levels of education or progression through, you know, a military unit or whatever that then just kind of stick around, you know? And they stop being a functional thing, and they more become, like, about pageantry or more as, like, revering the legacy of a thing that maybe meant something specific a long time ago but now has no real place in modern society, but you stick around and you keep wearing those funny hats or whatever. There's a thing that still is going on today called swan upping that involves funny hats, which I enjoy. They're sort of like almost look like a paper sailboat you might drop in the Thames, but in hat form. So this is something that's been happening for about 900 years. We maybe alluded to it a little bit earlier about the idea of the swan masters who would check the marks and, you know, kind of do a count and make sure that, you know, they claimed all of the unmarked swans. That is called swan upping. And so they row out now as part of this, like carrying on this tradition. They've been doing this for 900 years. These men row up and down the Thames looking to mark, check, and count the swans. And actually, you can see a great video of it on YouTube. You just type in swan upping. They weigh them. They actually lift them out by hand of the water and weigh them on a scale. And you know, keep a ledger of like all of the swans in the Thames. And in some, you know, sad yet unsurprising news, this year's swan upping ceremony will not be taking place. It dates back to the 12th century, and I believe this may be the first swan upping ceremony that's been canceled. because of the pandemic.
Yeah, because of the pandemic, right? I'm not aware whether or not it was canceled at some point during World War II or other times of great turmoil. Nowadays, it still exists because that tradition is very useful. It's a conservation tool. It's a predecessor of the operations that conservationists take around the world, you know, tagging and monitoring populations of wild animals. Technically, now, all unmarked swans on open water belong to the queen, but the queen only exercises this ownership right on this one stretch of the Thames. And when killing swans was outlawed in the 1980s, the population of England was shrinking, and a lot of people nowadays believe that the queen is the only person allowed to eat mute swans. Here's a bit of weird British plot twistery for you. That's not exactly correct, but it is maybe correct in practice, because remember, the Queen of England is considered immune from prosecution. So if she woke up one day and said, "I just want to eat swans forever," legally no one could really stop her. It's good to be at the top, I guess.
And hey, you might be asking yourself, "I don't live in the UK. I really want to eat a swan. How do I go about this?" It is a thing. It's sort of like an exotic meat, like pigeon or emu or like ostrich. And you see these here and there, certain types of restaurants that would specialize in kind of more game type meats. Mm-hmm. But you still aren't going to see swan on the menu. And there's a reason for that. It is technically in the United States legal to hunt and kill swans if you have the appropriate permit. I don't know how that would go. Where are there wild swans in the U.S.? I'm not sure. But nobody really does it. And nobody, well, if they do, they might do it for trophy purposes, right?
Sure.
But even that, already, can you sense where I'm going with this? Kind of weirds people out. It would sort of be the equivalent of like hunting puppies. You know, and I don't know why, considering what we've said about the nightmare fuel that is a swan, I feel like they should all be hunted down and eliminated personally.
Wow.
But that's a hot take. I'm only half serious, three quarters serious, but it's because of something called the meat paradox. And there's actually a really cool article on The Outline that talks about why don't we eat swans, knowing that we eat things like turkey and goose and even rabbit. We talked about this actually with Casey on a previous episode about where do we draw the line. And this is a thing. It's called the meat paradox. Mm-hmm. And this is the mind's way of kind of coping with this disfluency over, like, you know, what animals are okay to eat, what animals do we associate more sentience and intelligence with. And it's also kind of, it doesn't always work out, because as we talked about with Casey, pigs are very intelligent, but yet we have no problem with eating them. They're also kind of cute, even though they roll around in their own filth.
People would eat anything, though. I mean, that's why starvation cannibalism exists.
Exactly. But for some reason, swans fit squarely within that no-no zone of the meat paradox. Go figure.
Yeah, this is interesting. So you can catch, a swan, you could eat it. You can buy swans in the U.S. Many people do, but it's more of an ornamental thing. You can go to any number of institutions and they'll just have swans hanging out. They fell out of favor as food. Partially, there's sort of a positive feedback loop. Part of the reason they fell out of favor as food is because if you are manufacturing swans for consumption, you have to compete with the huge economic scale of other mainstream meat manufacturers and other, well, we would call them exotic meat manufacturers, you know, squab, quail, pigeon, etc.
And I'm having a little bit of a hard time finding if this is entirely true, because there's some folks saying that it's sort of a myth, but there is this notion that swans mate for life. And that's another reason that I think folks are differentiating them from other creatures, because there's this notion, there's even a quote in that article that we were talking about, the image of a lonely swan searching fruitlessly for its butchered partner would surely make even the most obnoxious bacon is my personality meat bro think twice.
So we can say that, presentation aside, it's probably not going to change your life to eat a swan. You don't have to enjoy them. You can just see these lovely creatures, lovely from far away, the same way that maybe a bonfire looks lovely far away. You can enjoy it from a distance, but we don't recommend hanging out with them in person. If you are the caretaker of some swans, we'd love to hear from you. Have you ever eaten swan? Have you tried it? How'd you cook it? I found a couple of great recipes, but I myself have not made swan.
You can find us on the internet in places. We've got Instagram and Facebook and all that for Ridiculous History. Our recommendation, as you know, is typically to join the Facebook group, the Ridiculous Historians, where you can share memes about swans and their horrible hellscape of a mouth and tongue situation. There's definitely some of those out there. If you want to trigger me with other bird pictures and stories, or perhaps Ben with pictures of metal, you can do that there too. And we do kind of creep through the group.
I did not agree to this.
Well, okay. Do what thou wilt is what I say. And let the chips fall where they may. But yeah, you can find that on Facebook. You can also find us as individual human people. I'm pretty much only on Instagram, and I am at How Now Noel Brown there.
You can see me encountering very strange foods, actually, on my Instagram, at Ben Bolin. You can also find me on Twitter, where I am at Ben Bolin HSW. Thanks again to our fantastic guest, super producer, Andrew Ahow, a.k.a. Cool Guy Deluxe Howard, a.k.a. Swan Master, a.k.a. Mr. Magic Hour. Thanks so much for joining us today, Andrew.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I hope you mean it, because I think you're recording another episode with us. So thanks as well, as always, to Alex Williams, who composed this slappin' bop you hear at the beginning and end of every episode. Thanks to the Quister.
Hey, and speaking of the slappin' bop, or as I like to refer to it as the bop and slap, any intrepid remixers out there? Sample that business. Send it back to us. Alex would be tickled. You know, do a remix of the Ridiculous History theme. That would be a lot of fun. Homework assignment to any musicians or home bedroom recording artists out there. Not mandatory, but it'd be fun to hear. Jonathan Strickland, that devious, notorious Quister, who I believe will be Zoom bombing us again very soon. Thanks to Degay Bluzier, who is our intrepid research associate. Thanks to Christopher Osiotis. Here in spirit.
Shout out to Swan Songs, and of course, as I always like to say in these episodes, to our number one fan, the Queen of England, thanks for tuning in.
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive, with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.